أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد.
ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المظلومين، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه وهو أصدق القائلين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا، واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها، كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون. صلوات الله محمد.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
As we come towards the end of this series on Orthodox Islam, tonight we want to begin our discussion with first talking about whether Islam has an interest and an opinion in how Muslims should govern themselves, or whether Islam is merely faith for the individual. The actions that we have seen so far from the past caliphs, in, for example, how immediately after the passing away of the Prophet ﷺ, they changed some of his policies and some of the rules within Sharia. And then in the later caliphs, the Umayyad and Abbasids, in how they lived a life contrary to the life of the Prophet ﷺ in building palaces and living like kings, suggests that Muslims may have been fooled into having this belief and idea that religion was a personal matter and it was a private matter. The governments of all these different periods was seen as supporting Islam and upholding its values by building mosques and by providing social services, but in reality Muslims and Islam was used for their own intentions and growth. It was used, for example, to justify invading other lands in the name of jihad in order to gain access to more natural resources in those other lands and to collect taxes from the peoples of those other lands. And the wealth then became something that was personal to them, and they became royal families where they decided how that wealth of the ummah would be spent and where it would be spent and for what purposes. Now, this continued on, and we see this to this day in a lot of dynasties that exist in the Middle East, which on one hand present themselves as the guardians and the custodians of Islam and its holy sites, but on the other hand use the wealth of the land as their personal wealth, and they are the royal family above everyone else. In the early dynasties, because there was no oil, therefore they relied on these resources and land invasions and so on to collect taxes and so on for their wealth. When the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1922 and the Khilafat came to an end officially in 1924, a few years after, in 1938, oil was discovered in what is today Saudi Arabia. It was first discovered in an area called Dammam, that is today's Dhahran. And this now became the black gold, and so it merely shifted from the Turks having that sort of a control over Muslims to now others in the Middle East, in the name of Saudi Arabia, for example, having access to this enormous amount of wealth and now taking that wealth to put themselves in a position where they now speak on behalf of Islam, even though their ideology represents a very small minority of Muslims. What we have tried to show in all these previous nights is that the reason why Islam spread so quickly in the world is because Islam was not taught and spread as a religion for the individual. It was not taught as a faith for one individual who seeks higher realization, but rather it was spread as a religion for the community. Salvation was not being offered as an individual salvation, but as a communal salvation. And there are many, unfortunately, today as well amongst the Muslims who still believe that Islam has nothing to do with politics, and there is a complete separation of, so to speak, church and state, and that these two have nothing to do with each other. As an example, the first prime minister of Iran after the revolution of Iran in 1979, Mahdi Bazargan, he was an individual who held this opinion that the purpose of the mission of all the prophets was to teach people about the afterlife, to teach people how to become more spiritual, and to teach people about God. But Islam was never meant to teach people how to govern themselves and how to manage their own affairs. And so it was not necessary for people to turn to the Quran to discover, for example, the laws of science or how to govern themselves or politics or economics and all such matters. For all such things, he argued that Muslims, just like non-Muslims, should rely on what he called collective reason. And then this idea has now been promoted further by individuals like Dr. Surush and others that you may have heard from. But what we are arguing is that the idea that Islam was meant to inspire only the individual for higher spirituality, but never to define the framework of governance in a political system, is against the obvious reading of the Quran. Now, I want to share some evidence of this from the Quran. First of all, it is naive to believe that spirituality can be attained without giving any attention to how one governs oneself in this world and without any religious regulation. Let us take a very simple example. Supposing we run a government and a society, and because of what people want, our collective reason determines that our society, as a democratic one where we use collective reason, should allow the existence of casinos and nightclubs and other such places, because this promotes freedom, this promotes human rights, and this is good for job growth and economy. Now, can we still believe that this decision that was the result of collective reason will not have any impact on the spiritual growth of the individuals who live in such a society? So we begin to see that collective reasons will make decisions based on the physical needs of people without paying attention to the spiritual need, but there is an inextricable connection between the two. Furthermore, if religion is personal and spiritual growth is only for the individual and not for the society and the community, then why does Islam prohibit monasticism? If you look at, for example, chapter 57, verse 27, there is a very clear condemnation of Rahbaniyya and what the Christians did in setting up monasteries where people who sought higher forms of realization and spirituality isolated themselves from society to seek this spirituality. Islam condemns that. Why does Islam insist that there is greater reward when you engage in acts of worship in a communal basis, as a community? Why is there more thawab to pray salat in jama'at, when the fact of the matter is you can concentrate more and focus more if you pray alone at home? Why is there such emphasis on Hajj, for example? Why does Islam talk about the obligation to fulfill things that help, that fulfill social needs, like paying the mandatory zakat, for example, or prohibiting usury, for example, riba? You can begin to see that Islam is not just interested in the individual soul and spirituality, but in setting up a society and a community that is spiritual, because it is only in that atmosphere that individuals and families can be fostered to be more spiritual. And that is the success of Islam thus far, that it calls for salvation at a communal basis and not at an individual basis. verse 59, Allah does not simply ask the faithful to obey Allah and His Prophet. He says, أَطِيعُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُوا الرَّسُولَ وَأُولِي الْأَمْرِ مِنْكُمْ. Obey Allah and obey His Messenger, and obey the one vested with authority amongst you. Right here then we see that Allah wants someone to be obeyed even after the Prophet. In chapter 5, verse 55, where he talks about who is your guardian, إِنَّمَا وَلِيُّكُمُ اللَّهِ. Your guardian is Allah, and your guardian is the Rasul. And then there is a description of who your guardian is, the one who establishes prayer, the one who gives zakat while he is in ruku. So again, once more we see that the idea of wilaya and wali is being extended beyond Allah and His Messenger. And therefore the argument that the Prophet was only a messenger and he came and revealed and delivered a message and went away, and now Muslims have to use their collective reason, does not seem to agree with the Quran thus far. It seems to be calling for some sort of a guardian. The Quran also doesn't just guide in matters of hereafter in spirituality. In Surah Al-Baqarah chapter 2 verse 213, it says that this Quran has been revealed as well that it may judge between the people in matters concerning which they differ. لِيَحْكُمَ بَيْنَ النَّاسِ فِي مَا اخْتَلَفُوا فِيهِ. So now the Quran is also being used to settle disputes and discord between people. So again we see it is not individual. And then in Surah Al-Hadid, again chapter 57, verse 25, Allah says that He sent apostles, He sent messengers, He sent rusul, and with them He sent the book and the balance, the mizan, so that mankind may maintain justice. لِيَحْكُمَ النَّاسُ بِالْقِسْطِ. Now what you should note here is that it is not the rusul who are supposed to maintain justice. He sent the messengers with the book and the balance so that people may establish justice. So people are now being asked to establish a society that is just. And then again we see that if Allah had no opinion in how people govern themselves, then He wouldn't, for example, have said in chapter 2, verse 205, condemning those who have authority and are unjust. He says, those who, if they were to take authority, they would cause corruption in the land, and they would ruin the crop and the stock, and Allah does not like corruption. He's talking about people who, if they were given authority, they would cause fasad on the earth. So you begin to see that there is this constant theme again and again. Those who have faith are being told that be maintainers of justice. كُنُوا قَوَّامِينَ بِالْقِسْطِ. Even if it is against your own selves. وَلَوْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِكُمْ. This is again in chapter 4, verse 135. And then I mentioned this verse before in one of the previous nights in Surah Al-Ma'idah, chapter 5, verse 8, where Allah says, وَلَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ عَلَىٰ أَن لَا تَعْدِلُوا. اِعْدِلُوا هِيَ أَقْرَبُ لِلتَّقْوَىٰ. Do not let your hatred for other people drive you to become unjust. Be just always. That is closer to being God-weary. So there is this constant thing about justice. And then finally in chapter 11, verse 85, Allah says, observe fully the measure and the balance with justice, and do not cheat people of their goods, and do not act wickedly on the earth, causing corruption. So we begin to see that the Quran now ties the individual salvation and success in the afterlife directly with upholding just and God-conscious society on the earth. And that is impossible without acknowledging that there is some sense of Islamic politics, some sense of Islamic government, some idea of Islamic sociology, Islamic economics. And it is not merely faith and practice and worship and an individual salvation. Now, it is true that most of the verses of the Quran are not about laws, and most of the verses of the Quran talk about spirituality and the afterlife and calling towards God. And the fuqaha tell us that there is about 500 ayats of Quran that are called ayatul ahkam, verses on the laws and the sharia. And in a Quran that is over 6,000 plus verses, this is a small number. But this number as well is very still very supportive and significant in suggesting that there is sociopolitics and science in the Quran, and that Islam does care and does have an opinion about this. Now, we have mentioned last night that where Muslims failed was in striking a balance between one extreme and the other extreme, between reforming Islam and reviving Islam, between that, so to speak, Mu'tazali leaning and Ash'ari leaning, between wanting change in a very liberal manner and modernity versus being very strict and literal in interpretation of the Quran. And the solution lies in between, in trying to extract and plumb and mine from the Quran principles on whose basis a society can be established that can still adopt modern ideas without being disloyal to the values of Islam and the Sharia. So for example, if we were discussing in modern times the establishment of a government and we were trying to decide, should this government adopt democracy or communism or socialism, or should it be a theocracy and a religious and an Islamic republic and so on, we can still talk about having some sort of collective reason that will argue and say, for example, in a country like Iraq, the majority are not Shia, so you can't potentially set it up as you set it up in Iran. Or in another country, Muslims are, for example, a minority, so you can't set it up in that sense as well. So that collective reason of how should we govern ourselves can still be there. But along with that, there could still be this idea that we don't jeopardize the principles and the primary mission of the prophets who came, because their primary aim was for humanity to attain salvation. And as we have said, Islam's mode of trying to give human salvation is collective and is communal. Now, I want to now jump to another subject here that is related to this, to say that when we look at society today, we find that our societies are absent of God. God has become a private matter in all faiths and religion. You will see yourselves as well when you go out to work in the corporate world, when you work outside, you hesitate to talk about religion and God, isn't it? Because people look at you funny. The moment you talk about God, they think of you as being a zealot or a crusader or a jihadist or somebody like that. You might be talking about the love of God, but it is no longer acceptable to talk about religion. On the other hand, there is, in this godless society, there is a lot of a sense of individualism, and science is considered to be God. There is a lot of faith in science and what it provides us and what it discovers. Now, for most people, religion now plays a very small role. A lot of people you will meet, for example, may have been born to Christian families, and they might tell you, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, or I don't follow organized religion. There is a history of how science came to be so important in our lives and religion came to be so insignificant in human societies, and particularly in Western societies. There was a time when Muslims were the leaders in science. And then, as we said last night, because of their backwardness in thinking, refusal to learn foreign languages, refusal to use the printers to print their books and so on, they were taken over by the Europeans, and the Europeans now became the masters of science and invention. In Europe, there was a history of the church persecuting scientists. You've all heard, for example, of the Roman Catholic Inquisition and so on. And eventually, there was a backlash that led to this separation of church and state. There was a time when people always believed in God. And in fact, if you read the history of natural sciences, you will see that the early scientists in Europe were actually very religious people. Right? Nobody would normally pay you most people would not accept even any sum of money as wage to go out and stand in a lightning storm and fly a kite with a key just to, you know, try out some scientific experiment. But a lot of these people who were inventing things, their motive was the same as that of the Muslim scientists. They wanted to prove the power of God. They wanted to prove what they found in the Bible. They wanted to prove through those scientific discoveries that God does exist. It is the opposite now where scientists will use science and research to prove God does not exist. But the early scientists, particularly if you study the history of natural sciences, you will see their aim was to actually prove that actually there is God. Now, a lot of disillusionment with religion was because science, as science progressed, it constantly was comparing itself not to all the religions of the world, but specifically to Christianity. And ideas such as there was a physical God sitting up on the heavens, some old man with a big white beard looking down at the earth, or the idea of God taking a physical form and coming onto the earth, it seemed fantastic and unbelievable to most people as they progressed in science. Many scientists in the early days were risking their lives if they were to suggest that the earth was the center of the universe or that it was not flat and so on and so forth. As philosophers progressed as well, they were dwelling on subjects like epistemology, and they were asking questions like, what is knowledge? What is reality? What is the truth? Who am I? Do I even exist? How do I know I am real? And so on and so forth. And as they were doing this, they were asking, is there any reality beyond my senses? Now, there is a very interesting history of how these empiricists, the people who came to argue that we can only trust on what we observe and what we can prove through our senses, and they came to call themselves the positivists or the logical positivists. There is a whole history to this that goes back to 1920s and 1930s. There was a Vienna Circle and there was a group in Berlin, and they used to meet regularly and they used to discuss, and they formed different rules of how things would be measured in science versus superstition and so on and so forth. Now, the long and short of it was that science sought to argue that everything you believe in must have tangible proof. If I cannot understand or reproduce something in a lab, then it doesn't exist. And this proof should not be based on mere faith or belief, but on empirical proof and on sense perception. And of course, they discovered many things and many rules around which humans progressed. They discovered the cure to illnesses, they discovered new technologies, they discovered new machinery and new inventions. And so this started giving this impression to people that science was more useful than faith and religion. It delivered something tangible, whereas religion, particularly in Europe, seen through the lens of Christianity, was seen as something that merely promoted superstition and belief in fairies and miracles and so on. Right? Oftentimes, science would also disprove something that was held by the superstitious and the religious. So as an example, if a person had some form of mental health illness, the religious and the superstition would talk about the person being possessed by the devil and jinn and so on and so forth. Science would come along and talk about autism and different forms of mental health issues and offer some sort of hope through which people can be helped. So the more this happened, the more religion fell out of value and favor in the eyes of people. Science was seen as being something positive, something constructive. Religion was seen as something backward. Now, this is Christianity now in Europe at the time. From an Islamic perspective, the Quran was not trying to improve people's lives from a physical perspective. The Quran does have ayats where it mentions science, where it mentions signs of Allah. But the primary aim of the Quran and Hadith is not to talk about physical need. You will see the Quran talk about, for example, eat clean food, or observing tahara and purity, or the miraculousness and health benefit of honey, for example. These sort of things are mentioned in the Quran, but the focus is on spirituality and salvation. The idea in the Quran is to uphold justice, to help men fulfill a destiny that transcends this world. This is because, from an Islamic perspective, the existence of this world is temporary. And this existence is also an animalistic one, and it is a very short journey in compared to the ultimate journey of one gaining higher consciousness of one's creator. Now, Besides that, Islam also holds the belief that whatever humans need for their whatever they need for their physical needs, they will discover themselves sooner or later. So given enough time, men will learn even how to go to space. Men will learn how to cure illnesses. So the Quran does not spend a lot of time telling humans how to go to space or how to cure this illness or that illness or how to build buildings and so on. Because humans will learn this as they interact with their physical world. On the other hand, humans have no access of knowing the unseen world, that which is beyond their senses. So the Quran focuses on that which humans will not be able to discover through experiment and through observation and through testing and trial and so on and so forth. So the Quran now focuses, for example, on bringing a realization in human beings that there is a life after death. Or for example, that there is a spiritual existence and a soul you possess besides your physical existence. Or for example, that whatever actions you do in this world has a consequence on your soul. And these affect an eternal existence after you live a short life here for 6, 7, 8, 9 decades on this planet. Now, as I said, in the early days, Christianity was opposed to science, and anyone who suggested anything that opposed the Bible risked their life. And this gave rise to the idea that you cannot have both. You cannot have science and religion. You would have to choose. Either you be the religious kind who says the earth is flat and the earth is the center of the universe, or you be the scientific, blasphemous kind, the heretic, who believes in science and does not believe in religion. And this gradually then gave emphasis to atheism and agnosticism. And people who weren't sure, they said, I'm agnostic. I'm not made up my mind. Does God exist or does he not exist? So I'll just leave it at that. It was easy to ignore religion because its relevance was not seen in people's daily lives. The church tried to recover in some degree by, for example, not talking about hellfire. If you look at the Bible, there are verses that talk about hellfire. But you will be hard-pressed today to find any church that on a Sunday will deliver a sermon and frighten people with hellfire. They will only talk about love, for example, of God. Right? Now, people began asking questions when they were initially hearing of all these verses about hellfire. Now they were taking control in their hands, and instead of submitting to a higher power, they were challenging it and saying, for example, I don't like being threatened. What kind of a God is this that threatens me? If God says to me, you have to do this, otherwise I'll put you in the fire of hell, that's like a man putting a gun to my head and saying, you have to do this, otherwise I'll shoot you. Well, go ahead and shoot me, because what's the value of believing or doing something when I'm not convinced? You're merely forcing me to do it. So that sort of an attitude was taken, and it was now easier to be anti-religion. You just needed enough people to start saying this, to build enough support so that now you could publicly proclaim these sort of ideas. Islam, and particularly the madhab of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, had a different understanding. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. The Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam taught that Allah is the only reality, and man is in a constant journey towards this reality. Hellfire was not something that Allah picks you and puts you in the fire of hell. Rather, it was something that you end up in when you move away from complete consciousness of your Creator. It is a place where you feel complete absence, and you have no consciousness of your God. In other words, your actions translate and transform into a reality in which your soul will then abide. Or to put it differently, it is in your hands and it is you who creates your heaven or your hell. So it is not Allah who punishes you. Allah, on the other hand, is constantly seeking to bring you towards Him and to give you higher consciousness and awareness of Himself, because that is where you will find a deep sense of tranquility, and that is where you will find inner peace and eternal bliss. And that is why you see now the Quran constantly saying, وَمَا ظَلَمُونَ وَلَكِنْ كَانُوا أَنفُسَهُمْ يَظْلِمُونَ. When they sinned and when they rebelled, it was not us that they were harming, but they were only harming themselves. And there are other verses of the Quran where Allah says, we will give you nothing but your actions back to you on the Day of Judgment. And we will say, this is what you did. So unfortunately, this perspective of religion, this idea of God, was not present. There are some groups in Muslims, such as the Wahhabis, who subscribe to an anthropomorphic idea of God, that God is a physical existence, that he is physical and every Thursday night he comes down and so on and so forth. But for the most part, Muslims do not believe in this idea of tajassum. Now here let me say something, that even though scientists and atheists in particular will give you the impression that they hold themselves very strictly to science and to not believing in anything without proof, the reality is that when you probe hard enough, you will see that they also are not as scientific as they make it out to be. And that people buy into it because they don't see an alternative, and they completely identify with their physical existence, so they think science is the new God. But if you probe hard enough, you will find that a lot of scientific, quote-unquote scientific evidence is actually based on faith. Perhaps I'm putting it too simplistically, but just this morning I was looking at an article that was saying, what is the difference between religious faith and scientific faith? And the person was trying hard to argue that scientists and atheists don't go along on the basis of faith. He said, well, religious faith is like when you as a Christian say that Jesus was born of a virgin birth, which is impossible. Or when you as a Muslim say that the Prophet Muhammad went up to the heavens on a horse that was winged, for example. He says there is no way for you to prove this, so it is just based on faith. But science, when they say the grass is green, they explain why it is green. When they say the stove is hot, they can explain why it is hot. Now, here there is a very unfair comparison, because these are very simple things that don't require tremendous amount of scientific proof. But supposing a scientist tells you things like, we found ice on a planet that is billions of light years away. You now believe this and you don't question it at all. When the Quran talks of a miracle, you say, I wonder if that actually happened. But a scientist tells you billions of light years away, we found ice on a planet, you don't even doubt it for a moment. Because we have all bought into this idea that science is right and everything else is not as accurate as science. A lot of scientific experiments is only based on studies and trials. So let us take an example. A scientist or a researcher will take a small segment of the human race, maybe 2,000 people, make them drink coffee for 6 months, and then conclude that coffee is very good for you. It is an antioxidant, and it actually reduces heart disease. Now, of course, coffee is addictive as well. It's got caffeine. It's a drug. So there's all the more reason why I wouldn't want to question that. In fact, I wouldn't want to know more if this is potentially a lie, because this is exactly what I want to hear. But supposing now I start asking questions, who funded this research? Was it that coffee company? The one that makes millions by selling coffee, for example? And did you eliminate all external factors that could have interfered with the results of this study, such as the gender of the participants, their age, their medical history, their genetic disposition, the type of coffee you used, and so on and so forth? And they do admit that they try and eliminate all these factors, but there may be factors that they may not be aware of. So science, when it defends itself, what it says is, it says, when we tell you something is a scientific truth, it's just a conjecture. It's our best guess at this point. And we are constantly experimenting again and again. And when we have a better conjecture, we will replace it with another guess that we think is better. And that will be the new scientific truth. And therefore, when I tell you as a scientist, this is the truth, I leave a door open to say, I may be wrong, but if I correct it, you will have the same level of conviction on the new truth that that is true. And so I can go back and forth every day and tell you, this month coffee is bad, next month coffee is good. This month eggs is bad, next month coffee is bad. This month orange juice is bad, next month is bad. But I'm constantly doing research, and I'm allowed to do that conjecture. Religion, on the other hand, cannot do that, because religion argues that it is sacred and it is from God. So God cannot be experimenting. His knowledge has to be perfect. So if religion changes its mind, it is seen as the religion itself has a problem, and it is false. Now, Consider as well, for example, the argument on Darwinism and evolution. A lot of people who are religious have been arguing for a long time, where is the fossil evidence? Have you ever seen any fossil evidence of a creature that was half this creature and half that creature that would prove evolution? They have their own arguments. I realize I'm putting it very simply here. But if you keep pushing and pushing and asking questions, you will come to a point where you will see that belief is also based on faith. It's not based on something concrete that is 100% sure. Or, for example, when scientists will tell you there were these dinosaurs, and our kids all love dinosaurs, right? They'll tell you all these 30-letter names that I cannot even pronounce. But when you look at these dinosaurs, they have different structures, long necks, horns, and then they have very interesting colors. They have a blue and a green and a bit of red on the forehead and a bit of orange. And I used to wonder, they found the fossil and the skeletons. How did they know what colors these dinosaurs are? So I began looking into it, and I came to the conclusion that some of the things they discovered, like they'd see in the stomach some food leftovers, and through that they'd know if it was a carnivore or a herbivore and so on. But on color, they have some ideas through this and through that, but it's work in progress. But rest assured, if one of those dinosaurs was brought back to life, they might be surprised at how different it looks from what they predicted. But we never question it. We completely believe that. So I'm trying to show you that science in some ways also is based on guesswork and faith. And the Quran says this in chapter 6, verse 116. وَإِن تُطِي أَكْثَرَ مَن فِي الْأَرْضِ يُضِلُّكَ عَن سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ If you were to follow and obey most of the people on the earth, they will lead you astray. إِن يَتَّبِعُونَ إِلَّا الظَّنَّ They are only conjecturing. وَإِنْ هُمْ إِلَّا يَخْرُصُونَ It is only guesswork. Okay. So now we conclude from this that man has an animalistic side and man has a divine side, which I have previously described as tabi'a and fitra. Now, as religion became less relevant and science became the new God, whose word was now unquestioned, humans now began asking that if there is no God and I'm here by accident, and when I die I simply disappear into oblivion, then what is the purpose of my existence? Do I have a purpose? Is there anything that I can call good or bad? From where do I have this sense of justice or sense of beauty or right or wrong? If everything evolved through time and everything evolved because there was a need for it, what caused the need for humans to have a sense of humor, for example, or a sense of justice, or a sense of beauty, or a sense of spirituality? So, despite knowing that this world is temporary, and I am just an animal, and I am here by accident, why do I still crave immortality? How do you explain this through evolution and through Darwinism? Why do I still crave for perfection? If it was only a survival of the fittest that has brought us to this point, why are some humans selfless? You can understand a human being killing another one to dominate over him because that is survival of the fittest. It complies and agrees with the Darwinian theory. But when a human being is willing to cut his own body open and donate an organ or give blood, how do you prove that through Darwinism and evolution? That is completely contrary to the idea of survival of the fittest. Where did this notion and idea come into humans? So, this, if people were to obey, there is yet another example. Why do humans obey any laws in society? If we are here by accident, there is no God, there is no purpose in life, and when I die, I go into oblivion, why should I obey the law? They say you should obey the law because that is the only way a civil society will exist. So for the good of the whole society, I agree to obey the law, you agree to obey the law, and as we obey the law, we can then have a society. So now we ask from that, if there is no good or bad, and we obey laws only to uphold civility in a society, is it okay for me to steal or to harm someone if I know I'll get away and it won't change society? Supposing I walk into Walmart and I sneak out a chocolate bar and I eat it without anybody seeing. It doesn't change anything, right? Because there is no accountability. Once I die, I disappear. It's oblivious. And how does that change society? And everybody starts thinking like that, and then it degenerates. Now, so humans now began feeling purposeless. Once they left religion, science became God. Science began promoting atheism. Now humans started feeling dejected, purposeless, depressed. Why should I even live? So now they turned their attention to their physical existence and to materialism and said, well, if I have to live out this purposeless life, I might as well enjoy myself and indulge in every fantasy and desire that I can. So now life became all about the pursuit of pleasure and wealth and comfort and luxury and wanting fame and controlling others so that I always have the upper hand. So now the God of humans changed once more. That science that was God was now replaced by a new God, and this new God was now my ego. Humans now began worshipping their own selves, their egoic selves. And now my idol was my nafs, myself, my lower base self. Interestingly, the Quran talks about this as well, in two places. And in Surah Jathiyah, chapter 45, verse 23, it says, أَفَرَأَيْتَ مَنِ اتَّخَذَ إِلَهَهُ هَوَاهُ وَأَضَلَّهُ اللَّهُ عَلَىٰ عِلْمٍ. Have you seen him whose lust is his God? Whose hawa, whose base desire is his ilah, is his God. You can go up and look at this verse further. I don't wish to go into the detail of explaining it. But man's fitra, man's divine nature was still not agreeable to this. It still screamed that I don't want to be seen behaving like an animal whose only preoccupation is pleasure. If I'm going to be preoccupied with pleasure and greed and materialism, I want validation for it. I want to be admired for it. So now humans began conjuring statements to justify and feel good about it. They began saying about themselves, you live only once, so make the most of it. And now men began throwing out terms like human rights, freedom, tolerance, my democratic right, live and let live. Who are you to judge another? Individualism, diversity, equality. And truth now became liquid and subjective. And terms like chastity, modesty, piety, integrity were thrown out. I will define what is good and bad, because I am now God. And right and wrong will be defined on my terms in society of what is human rights and what is freedom. Now, there was another reason why man had to conjure up all these terms, and they were so important to the godless man. The reason is because sometimes humans needed other people to sacrifice their lives for them. For example, I enjoy my life here, a materialistic life. But when there is war between my country and another, I need someone else to go out and sacrifice their lives for me so that I can continue living my existence. Salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. I need everyone to move forward, please. Can you please stand up and take a few steps and move forward? Now, if you ask a soldier to go out and give his life for the country, based on that same idea of having evolved from apes and survival of the fittest, it doesn't make any sense. We are all trying to survive. Why should I give my life for you? Why should I shorten my life for you? So now we begin glorifying the idea of a hero. We began making up these things. On this hand, we believe there is no existence after life. On the other hand, we began saying that if you give your life, we will build a monument in your name. We will build a statue that looks like you. If we don't know your name, we will call it the unknown soldier. We will observe a 1 minute silence in your name. We will announce your name in public and name schools and institutions after you. We will carve your name on stone and put it up everywhere. Now, this still does not have an appeal to me, because once I die and I vanish, I don't get to see all this glory because I no longer exist. So I don't get to relish that there is a statue somewhere that looks like me, or people are observing a 1 minute silence for me. So what difference does it make whether you do something in my name or you don't do it? Because I don't see it, so I don't get to know of it. So now man had to emphasize terms like human rights, democracy, freedom, hero, sacrifice, and hopefully that fitra in insan that wants fame, that wants glory, that wants to sacrifice, that wants freedom, that wants to be a hero, it will kick in and now say, well, I'll go do it and be a hero. Hopefully I don't die, but, you know, maybe have the best of the both worlds. Now here, when these terms were being thrown out, freedom, equality, tolerance, democracy, and so on, there was a trap that was being laid for those who are religious. You see, not every human being fell for this idea of there is no God. There were still those who were religious and believed there was a higher power, and that there is life after death, and there is accountability, and that life without a purpose has no attraction to me. I'm not happy pursuing materialism if at the end of it I'm just going to cease to exist. The faithless, in their pursuit to end religion and to fight religion, began using these as value statements against the religion. So for example, they used equality in their terms and in their definition, and now questioned the religious and said, does your religion give equal rights to all humans? Oh yeah? How come a woman gets less inheritance than a man? How come a man's witness has more weight than a woman's witness? How can slaughtering an animal for food be kind? How can capital punishment be humane? How can you judge another human being, whether he's kafir or he's najis? And so they now started using terms like humanism, and it put the religious now on the defensive. And the trap here is that embedded in every value statement is a belief system. Liberalism has its own terminologies. Communism has its own terminologies. Socialism has its own terminologies. And in that same manner, Islam also has its own terminologies. Islam uses terms like ikhlas and iman and taqwa and halal and haram and taslim ilallah, submission to God, and ridallah, and so on. So now, when you are arguing with the atheist and talking about human rights or women's rights or whatever it is, are you talking about the same thing? You see, when you use terms like women in Islam, women's rights in Islam, Islamic feminism, democratic Islam, humanism Islam, this Islam, that Islam, when you're discussing this and defending it, you are already implying that in Islam, women are separate from men and they have been marginalized. And that in Islam, women, when the fact of the matter is that in Islam, women were oppressed before Jahiliyyah. Today, it is true that women are oppressed in countries, in some countries where the majority are Muslims, such as Afghanistan, for example. But that is not religion, that is culture. How do we know that? We know that because if you look at women in Egypt, or in Iran, or in Indonesia, or in Africa, where there are a majority of Muslims, you don't see that sort of oppression on women. If it was Islam, then the woman in Iran or Egypt or Indonesia should have been as oppressed as the woman in Afghanistan. So you have to then begin separating the two. Women will compete with men in these countries on an equal level for opportunities. The media has its bias in portraying that hijab, for example, is forced upon women and it restricts them, and that, you know, women don't have the same rights as men. So what we need to be cautious of first and foremost is that terms like equality, human rights, etc., they are laden with belief systems. And the first discussion that you would need to have with someone who has a different belief system is that, what do you understand by the word freedom? What is human rights in your definition? What do you mean when you say humanism? And when you realize that it is fluid, and the model of the person arguing is one in which human opinion is first, whereas the model on which you're arguing, God is first, then a lot of these objections become meaningless. Now, Muslims, to no exception of other faiths, as soon as they were faced with this crisis of a society that is godless, they immediately broke into two groups. One, as we discussed yesterday, was the modernists, the Mu'tazilite types. The other was the fundamentalists, or the Ash'arite types. And these were the ones who saw everything black and white as us versus them, Muslims versus the rest, or versus the West. Now, I want to very quickly talk about these two groups, and I don't know if I will cover everything tonight, but if I don't, I will continue on Monday. The modernists said, well, these statements that are being thrown at us, like feminism, humanism, freedom, empirical proof, bioethics, and so on, are good points, and we need to address these. We must show religion that, we must show science that religion is actually better than science, and we can use the same arguments. So we are now going to start writing books to show that the Quran already talks about all these things, and that all the science discoveries and proofs you have, the Quran already talked about it before. But now there is a problem here. Science can change its opinion. So once you have argued that this scientific discovery is in the Quran, when science changes its opinion, then what do you say now about the Quran? Because now you are on the defensive, trying to prove something that you don't have to. Now, these modernists now were completely trying to align with the modern man that is godless, that is constantly bashing at religion. They now began saying that, well, we should only use the Quran as a guideline, but we should use our collective reasoning to identify the truth, so that we are still Muslims, but we conform to science and modernity. Let's interpret everything in Sharia as being relative, and the Quran is only a broad guideline, so that now I will define the intent and will of God, and I will say what the Quran is trying to say. Based on human rights, as Muslims, let's promote a vegan diet, for example. Based on equality, let's prove that Islam never wanted polygamy. Based on human rights, let us say that Islam never wanted us to fast more than X number of hours, because that is inhumane. Now, that inhumane, you are defending it based on the understanding of someone who has a different belief system. And there was now a constant mantra that you hear nowadays that says, well, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense, to the point that now, if it doesn't make sense, then don't follow it. Now, how can you say a mu'min is better than a kafir when the kafir is giving more charity than a mu'min? So we, in a sense, have disconnected ourselves from the sources, and now we are obsessed with trying to conform to these terminologies and values that have been imposed on us. How can a girl or boy be baligh at such a young age? It's not justice. Perhaps we got it wrong. So let's change our Sharia and our faith to conform to what society calls justice and humane. Allah says, "La yukallifu Allahu nafsa, la yukallifu Allahu nafsa illa wus'aha." Allah does not try a soul beyond its capacity. So we're going to use this as a principle, and now we are going to decide what is beyond our capacity, and what is a burden and what is not a burden. So now we begin to say, I don't think my God would do this. My God does not allow this. The God that I worship does not say this. All these statements are true, but notice they are filled with the words my and I, my God, the God that I worship. So the question is, what is this God that you worship? Is it Allah or is it your ego? Because both could be the gods that you are referring to. And so we keep defining and redefining religion. And this now takes us on a slippery slope. And I will allude to this again on Monday when I talk about what I see as a prediction of where Islam will be in the West 20 years from now, if we continue along this path. The other issue with modernists and reformists is that the reason they failed to bring reforms, as we mentioned yesterday, is because in their attempts to bring reform, they felt that nothing was sacred. They could question Quran, Hadith, and anything in order to bring reform. And Muslims are very devout and loyal to their faith. They will not accept any reform or change unless you can prove that you still remain loyal to Quran, Hadith, and Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, very quickly, let's talk about the fundamentalists. When you look at any community, any center, any mosque, when they have a division and they break up, sometimes they break up for a valid reason. They break up because of distance, for example, and that is perfectly fine. Sometimes they break up because there is some administration issue or a disagreement on how to run the center. That as well we will not comment on. But sometimes the breakup is because of a fundamental difference in understanding of how we should practice our faith. When they do this, the first thing that happens is they separate themselves from the rest of the community. And then now labels are assigned where this group is pro this and anti this, and in favor of this and anti that. And over time and over decades, they now become completely two separate schools of thought. And this is actually how Muslims ended up becoming Shia Masjid, Sunni Masjid, except that now within the Shia you have groups and within the Sunni you have groups. Let me give you an example of why this is dangerous, that any individual in the community who seeks to reform it must find ways to reform from within rather than take a segment and create another school of thought. We used to have an individual at one point, way back in the 13th century, I think, or the 14th century, who was a mujtahid, and his name was Sheikh Ahmad Ahsa'i. Sheikh Ahmad Ahsa'i was a Shia mujtahid, and at first he only tried to bring about spiritual reform. At some point, because he took a lot of interest in Sufism, he started denying physical resurrection, and he started denying the bodily ascension of the Prophet ﷺ and Mi'raj. And he started filtering a lot of the things in eschatology and making them symbolic and esoteric. And then he went on to have some very extreme ideas about the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. When he did that, he separated from the rest of the Shia and he started a new madhab that were called the Shaykhis. The Shaykhis, when Sheikh Ahmad Ahsa'i died, he was succeeded by another individual. He died in 1826. He was followed by Sayyid Qasim Rashti. Sayyid Qasim Rashti left instructions before he died to his followers, the Shaykhis, that when the Mahdi returns, these are the signs by which you can identify him. And after he died, these Shaykhis, who had now numbered 10,000, went out looking for the Mahdi. And they met a man who was called Ali Muhammad Shirazi, who now began describing himself as the Bab. The Bab meaning the door, and he said he was now the door to the Mahdi. And that sect now transformed again, and from Shaykhis a group broke out, and now they became the Babis. And they started following another individual. Over time they were persecuted, and they from them went and met another individual who now claimed to be the Mahdi. So now those then end up became the Baha'is. So you now begin to see that from the Shia Ithnashiri, you have one individual who seeks reform, but then he brings in ideas that contradict the fundamental principles, and he brings in extreme ideas of the Ahlul Bayt. It breaks away and becomes a new sect. From that extremism of the Ahlul Bayt, they now leave signs of the Mahdi. Then there are extremists who go looking for the Mahdi, and when you're looking for something, you'll find it. So they go find somebody who says, I'm the Bab to the Mahdi, and the new sect is formed. And then from there they go now looking, and now they find the Mahdi himself. And the danger here is that when you set up a society that is completely taken in by only one individual, and there is almost this cult-like sense of worship of one individual, history repeats itself and it always follows the same pattern. That individual dies, the next person comes, he's not as charismatic as the first person, and it breaks away, it forms different sects, but it never makes any reform or change in the community, which was the original intention of that group that had first separated. So these are some of the things that we need to be
cautious about. I want to summarize here and say that when we look at all these issues, the dangers of the reformists who are constantly trying to, for example, make faith acceptable based on terminologies that have been put forward by those who belong to another belief systems, as well as those who take on extreme ideas, basically swinging to this side versus swinging to that side. If you summarize the root of all these problems, there are five issues, and I want to mention them very quickly and then end. The first is that science and modernism has become religion for one group of reformists. The second is that blaming others and extremism has become Muslims' pet peeve, and now the leaning point for the other group, the revivalists or fundamentalists. The third thing we observe is this sense of inferiority complex. There is this deep-seated idea that we need to the West in order to civilize ourselves. We cannot run our own schools. We cannot set up our own institutions. It is only the West that is civilized enough, and they and only they can teach us and educate us. We need European language. We need Western education. Otherwise, we are not seen as being civilized. So if you have a PhD in Urdu or Farsi or any other language, it doesn't seem to carry as much weight in our eyes. It has to be in a European language from a Western university. Even if that Western university has a school in the Middle East, we value sending our children to the West because our idea is that is the only place where you can find the quality of education. If a court in a Muslim country makes a decision, it's a kangaroo court. It has to be in the West before there is true justice that is given out. If someone speaks with an accent, then perhaps they are lesser educated and they're not as good as the person who speaks with the accent that is Western. Even if the person who speaks with an accent can speak six languages, whereas this person can only speak English. But these are remnants of colonialism that have stayed in the Muslim psyche, and it continues to stay there in that master-slave mindset. Kemal Atatürk of Turkey had tried this experiment. When he tried to modernize Turkey and force women to remove hijab and go out to work and, you know, remove Arabic script and replace it with a Latin script, and constantly trying to be part of the European Union even later, they never got what they want. And in the end, there was only humiliation. خَسِرَ الدُّنْيَا وَالْآخِرَةَ. So there is this inferiority complex as well that we need to talk about. The other concern about Muslims today is that when Muslims talk about reform, they go through a process that I call veneer Islam, where everything is just superficial, outward, fake. There is no deep change in the ummah. There is an interesting article you will find about Pakistan if you go to the Dawn newspaper online. There is an article that says when Khuda became Allah. And there is this whole idea of how when the Saudis came to Pakistan, they began enforcing this way of how to become more Islamic. And the way you became more Islamic is you could no longer say Khuda Hafiz, you had to say Allah Hafiz. Why? Because Khuda was Persian, and Persians are of course not Muslims. So you now had to say Allah Hafiz. Of course, they forgot to emphasize that if you're going to say it in Arabic, then it is Allah Hafiz, not Allah Hafiz. But nonetheless, there was that push. And the article goes on to say that they went to all places in Pakistan to promote these ideas. And suddenly now Pakistan became Pakistan. And Punjab became Punjab. And the author begins to write this. He says, Punjab is made up of two words, Panj and Ab, five rivers, the land of five rivers. What is Punjab? But this became now the push. And now, I have never been to Pakistan, but apparently, depending on how a person says goodbye to you, you know exactly their religious leaning. If he says Khuda Hafiz, you know where he is. If he says Allah Hafiz, you know where he is. You say Allah Hafiz, you say, he's Wahhabi. Right? I don't oppose saying Allah Hafiz, of course. It is the name of God. But these are the kind of changes Muslims are thinking, that this is how we can be more Islamic. Shorten our clothes, grow our beards, right? And if you go online, we talked yesterday of Sir Sayyid. Sir Sayyid, he was knighted by the queen. Look at his picture, you'll be amazed. Big cap, long beard, he looks like an Ayatollah, right? But he is Sir Sayyid. On the opposite, look at Sayyid Qutb. You will see a man with a suit and tie, clean shaven, and completely westernized until his later life. So these are the kind of things that Muslims are struggling with. And then finally, religion has become free for all. And this will be a big part of my conclusion on Monday. I will draw parallels and show you that just like Judaism split and became Orthodox Jews versus the more modern liberal Jews, and Christianity gave up the laws of Moses and became a religion that spoke of goodness without Sharia, if Muslims continue the way they continue, they will end up in the same state. And history will begin repeating itself. What we want to say in conclusion is that Islam is not against the intellect and the use of the intellect. And inshallah, on Monday, I will show you the evidence of this, that the path of the Ahlul Bayt is not one where you just take the Quran and you forsake Aql. But Quran is primary and Aql does not oppose Quran. But you hold both hand in hand. And what I will argue is that the dangers we face today and the solution to our problems as Muslims living in the West is that we have now adopted a policy where we feel we can cut ourselves loose from the ulama, the rightful traditional ulama, and we can figure things out ourselves going forward. And the solution is first to identify the qualities of the ulama that deserve to be followed, and then to show some subservience to them. Because what is happening is this sense of individualism where I want the opinion of everyone, but I am going to decide with help from Google what is right and what is wrong, and what I should do and what I shouldn't do on this issue. And this is in particular an issue that is plaguing societies in the West. And there are some examples that may be particularly relevant to us in Toronto as well, and particularly for the community whose ethnicity I belong to, the Khoja community. And so I want to, you know, again, in the same manner of being respectful but candid, criticize some of the attitudes that we have as a community that is leading us away from Orthodox Islam, and that we need to regain and re-understand the value of what we have in terms of adala, imama, and that we have something very precious in our hands, that direct connection to imama through the tradition of the ulama. And the idea that, you know, we do not wish to be patronized, and that we as Khojas have lived for centuries in Africa with our own people and our own local mullahs, and we have fared pretty well, and therefore we can take it from here on our own, is a dangerous idea. So there are people who don't have gold and have to go out looking for it. But there are people who are sitting on gold and they don't know they're sitting on it. The case of the Shia is the latter, and that's what I wish to, inshallah, highlight and present in whatever time I will have, inshallah, on Monday when I make a conclusion to this subject. If you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad. One more salawat ala Muhammad. صلى الله وسلم عليك يا رسول الله وعلى أهل بيتك صلى الله عليك يا مولاي يا أبا عبد الله يا رحمة الله الواسعة وباب نجاة الأمة لعن الله ظالمين لكم من الأولين والآخرين ما خاب والله من تمسك بكم وأمنا من لجأ إليكم فيا ليتنا كنا معكم سيدي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. ليلة عاشوراء، ليلة مصيبة. Tonight and tomorrow night there is a qiyama in the house of Zahra alayha salam. The historians narrate that on the 9th of Muharram, Ibn Ziyad sent the most wretched man in command of an army to Karbala, and his name was Shimr Dhul Jawshan. He was to be the second in command. When he came to Umar ibn Sa'd, he presented a letter from Ibn Ziyad. And the letter said to Umar ibn Sa'd that you have been in Karbala since the 3rd of Muharram, and you are having discussions with Hussein and writing to me letters asking me for a way out so that you still have the province of Ray, but you don't kill Hussein. I have now sent Shimr with this army. You must immediately force Hussein to either surrender and come to me and pledge allegiance, or you must fight him and kill him. And if you are not willing to do this immediately, then you must hand over power and control to Shimr Dhul Jawshan. When Umar ibn Sa'd read this letter, he said to Shimr that I know this is your doing, and it is you who instigated this letter. But I swear by Allah, I will kill Hussein, but I will not give you power and control. So he immediately sent a small troop to the camp of Hussein, demanding either surrender or go to battle. At this point, we are told, the sun was already beginning to set on the 9th of Muharram. When Imam al-Hussein found out that there are soldiers armed and ready to fight coming towards his camp, he called his brother Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, with whom he always addressed with utmost respect, and said, "Binafsi anta ya akhi, may I be sacrificed for you, my brother Abbas. Go see what they want." Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas goes and speaks to them, and they present him this letter. Now look at the jalal of Abbas. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas commanded such awe even in the enemy that if he drew a line in the sand, nobody would move as long as that line stood there. So he told them not to move and said, "Wait until I return." He comes back, he speaks to Imam al-Hussein. Imam al-Hussein says to Abbas, he says, "Go back and tell them that Hussein is asking for one more night, because Hussein loves to worship his Lord and he wants to spend this night in the ibadah of his Lord." The message goes back to Umar ibn Sa'd. He mocks Aba Abdullah and says, "Praying more will not help you," and so on and so forth, "but we will give you one more night until tomorrow." Here Imam al-Hussein is not asking for muhlat, he is giving muhlat. The proof of that is that if Hussein would have fought on the 9th of Muharram, then Hur would not have become Hur alayhi salam. And Imam al-Hussein was saving as many souls as he could save. Because of waiting for this, Hur now came to Hussein, the son of Hur came to Hussein, the servant of Hur came to Hussein. Furthermore, Imam al-Hussein knew that if I go to war as the sun is setting, then I do not wish these people to have an excuse on the Day of Judgment. I do not want them to be able to say to my Jad or to Allah that when we trampled the body of Qasim, we did not know this was the yatim of Hassan. Or that when we pierced the chest of Akbar, we did not know this was Shabih of Rasul because it was dark. Or that when Hussein fell from his horse, we did not know that Hussein had fallen from his horse. Imam al-Hussein wanted to ensure that when this happens, it happens in broad daylight. And so now we are told that once this was settled, the Ashab and Ansar of Hussein sat down together to worship Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As evening fell and the prayers had been done and the lamps were lit, Imam al-Hussein gathered all his Ashab and Ansar and all the men from his family in one place. The Rawi now is Imam Zainul Abideen. He says, my father gathered them all and began discussing and talking to them. He first delivered a lengthy khutbah in which he glorified Allah. Having glorified Allah, he began addressing his ashab and said, إِنِّي لَا أَعْلَمُ أَصْحَابًا أَوْفَى وَخَيْرًا مِنْ أَصْحَابِي. O my companions, I do not know of any companions more loyal and better than you. فَجَزَاكُمُ اللَّهُ خَيْرَ الْجَزَاءِ. May Allah reward you abundantly for these. By Allah, my Jad Rasulullah did not have ashab like I did. My father Ali did not have ashab like I did. My brother Hassan did not have ashab like you. And after glorifying them, Imam al-Hussein then now began discussing with them what was to happen the next day. He said to them, look, these people are only thirsty for my blood. These people only want me. You do not need to spill your blood. You have already shown your faithfulness. I permit you to leave. And nobody left. When nobody left, Imam al-Hussein began addressing them individually. He said, O Banu Aqil, O children of Aqil, you have already sacrificed Muslim bin Aqil. Enough blood from your family has been shed. You leave. Nobody moved. He then addressed his companions. Nobody moved. Then Imam al-Hussein said, perhaps you are concerned that what would happen to your salvation on the day of judgment. I, Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, am assuring you, if you leave, I guarantee you Jannat. I guarantee you my Jad Rasul will not complain about you. You can leave. Nobody moved from their place. Then Hussein alayhi salam said, perhaps you feel ashamed and embarrassed to leave while I'm watching you. I will put out the lights and I will make this dark so that you can slip out in the dark and nobody will see you leave. Hussein alayhi salam put out all the lights. He sat silently in the darkness for a little bit. Then when he put the lights on, there was an ajeeb manzar. When Hussein now looked on one side, Habib's head was lowered, he was crying. On the other side, Muslim was crying. On the other side, Burair was crying. Abul Fadl al-Abbas was crying. Zuhair stood up and began speaking. He said, Ya Aba Abdullah, by Allah, if we are killed 1,000 times and brought back to life, we will not leave you, O Hussein. How can we leave you when you now are the soul of our lives? Then Abul Fadl al-Abbas stood up and said, Mawla, Mawla, of what use then is life after you if we leave? Hussein said marhaba to his companions. Hussein now began showing with the ilmul ghaib that he has an imam. He began showing his ashab and ansar their maqam in Jannah. O Burair, this is what Allah has kept for you in Jannah. O Muslim, this is what awaits for you after Shahada. The ashab and ansar were overjoyed. Some of the arbab of Aza say they were joking and laughing with each other with the delight they had that the next day they would attain martyrdom. They all now began praying to Allah. Hamid ibn Muslim and others report that all you could see from the ashab of Hussein was they were raki'an wa sajidan, they were constantly prostrating and worshipping Allah. Wa kana dawiyuhum kadawiyun nahal. When you listen to the camp of Hussein, there was a buzzing sound like the buzzing of bees. There was tahleel and taqdis and takbir. Subbuhun quddus rabbuna wa rabbul malaika. There was constant tasbih the whole night in the camp of Hussein. But this was only one side on the camp of Hussein. On the other side of Hussein's camp, there were little voices calling out, Al-Atash, Al-Atash, Al-Atash. The children, helpless now, in the laps of their mothers, were crying for thirst. 3 days, the children of Zahra have been craving for water, but the enemy will not give any water to them. Imam Zainul Abideen alayhi salam says, at one point, Joan, the freed slave of Abu Dharr, was sharpening the sword of my father Hussein. Hussein was sitting and watching Joan. He began reciting some couplets and saying, Uffin laka ya dahrun min khalilin, kam laka bil ishraqi wal asilin. Oh, how faithful you are, O time, as a friend. How many sunrises and sunsets you have seen. But tomorrow when the sun rises, our bodies will be scattered on these sands. And yet there is no substitute for us. Imam Zainul Abidin says, as Hussein was reading this, he says, I began chalking back on my teeth. tears, and my aunt Zainab began weeping loudly. Hussein sat beside Zainab. Why is Hussein doing this? Hussein is slowly preparing his sister Zainab for tomorrow. He is preparing Zainab for the day of Ashura. Ajrukum alallah. As the Ashab and Ansar settled, Hussein now began walking around the camp. Hussein went around listening to all and watching what was happening in the khayam. He came to one khayam. He heard Farwa talking to Qasim, saying to Qasim, tomorrow is the day of jihad, O Qasim. Qasim, you are the son of Hassan. Do not hold back yourself. And Qasim was speaking with pride. You will see, Amma, how I do jihad tomorrow. Get me permission from my uncle Hussein. He went again. He saw Zainab talking to Aun and Muhammad. You are the children of Ja'far and Ali bin Abi Talib. Everyone is giving shuja'a and encouraging their children. But then he came to one khaymah. He came to one khaymah where his wife Rabab was sitting. Rabab was rocking a cradle and Rabab was weeping. She was talking to her baby Asghar and saying, "Ay kash, my child, if only you had grown up, you too would have gone to the Maidan for jihad." I would say, "Rabab, wait for the sun to rise the next day. Your jihad, the jihad of your Asghar, will not be any less than the jihad of Akbar. Ajrukum alallah." The sun rose the next day. The Ashab and Ansar of Hussein went for jihad. When all the Ashab and Ansar had gone, then the Aqruba began going. And when all the Aqruba had gone, then Imam al-Hussein was left all by himself. He went into the tents. He went into the tents of Ashab and Ansar, and they were all empty. Then he went into the tents of the Banu Aqil, and there was nothing but despair, and their last belongings were left lying there. Then he went into the camp of Abbas, and there was nothing there. When all the tents were empty, then Gharib Hussein came out. He stood under the hot sun. He raised his hands and began calling out, "Hal min nasirin yansurna?" Is there anyone who can come to our help now? There was no reply. Ajrukum alallah. Then Hussein Gharib began calling out, "Hal min mughithin yughithuna?" Is there anyone who can come to our aid? There was still no reply. He said, "Hal min dhabin yadubu an harami Rasulillah?" If there is no one to come to our aid, is there anyone who can come and protect the women of the Prophet? There was no reply. Suddenly Hussein heard women crying in the tents. He came towards the tents. He said, "Why do you weep? I am still alive." The women said, "Aqa and Mawla, when you were calling out, 'Hal min nasirin yansuruna,' Rabab's baby threw himself from the cradle in response to your call." Bas Hussein began to weep. He said, "Bring my son to me. I will take him to the Ashqiya. Perhaps they will give him a few drops of water." Now look at the ghurba of Rabab. When Rabab heard that Hussein is going to take his Asghar, he thought, perhaps if I make my child more beautiful, perhaps if I adorn my child, the enemy will show more mercy on him. Rabab put a new dress on Asghar. Then Rabab put kahal on the eyes of Asghar. Then she wrapped him in a swaddle cloth. Then she gave the baby to Hussein. "Aqa and Mawla, take my child and quench his thirst." Hussein took his baby and turned towards the Maidan. The enemy saw Hussein was now coming with something wrapped in his abba. They thought Hussein has brought the Quran. Hussein has come and asked for truce. Back in the khayam, Rabab stood outside watching. I told you on the night of Qasim, there were two mothers who stood outside to watch their children when they went to the Maidan. One was the mother of Qasim, the other was the mother of Asghar. But there was one difference between Farwa and Rabab. When Farwa stood outside, she knew Qasim was not going to come back. Rabab had no idea that her child will not come back. She was simply waiting to receive her baby back. Hussein came before the enemies. He opened his abba. They saw he is holding a baby. He began addressing them and saying, "Ya qawm, qad qataltum akhi wa ashabi wa awladi, fama baqiya ghayra hadat tifl." O people, you have killed my Abbas, you have killed my ashab, you have killed all my children. There is no one left now except this baby. He is thirsty for 3 days. Can you not spare some water for him? My Jad Rasulullah will reward you. There was no reply. Then Hussein began saying to them, O people, we have committed wrong in your eyes. What sin has this child committed? Again, there was no response. Then Hussein said, perhaps you think if you bring water, I will drink some water. Come, you give water to this baby. Again, there was no reply. When Hussein saw nothing moved them, he began asking them, O people, is there no sahib-e aulad amongst you? Is there no one amongst you with a child who will show mercy on this baby? Ajrukum alallah, ajrukum alallah. Imam al-Hussein had an older daughter called Sakina. On the night of Sham-e-Ghariba, when Sakina's eyes closed, she had a dream. In her dream, she saw her father Hussein. Hussein said to his older daughter Sakina, Sakina, when you go back to Medina, tell my Shia, Shiati, laytakun biyawmi ashura tanzuruni, kaifa astasqili. Oh my Shia, if only you had been with me on the day of Ashura, you would have seen how I was begging for water for my child. But they would not show mercy to the baby. Ajrukum alallah, ajrukum alallah. Bas, then Hussein said, perhaps Asghar should show them his thirst. He held the baby up and he turned them towards the enemy. He said to Asghar, you are also the child of an imam. My child Asghar, you do itmamul hujjah. You show them how thirsty you are. Some of the arbab of Azah say, when you take a fish out of water and when it no longer struggles, then it just lies there, and sometimes it opens its mouth and sometimes it closes its mouth, gasping for air. Asghar began to open his mouth and close his mouth. Then the little baby took his tongue out and he began turning his dry tongue on his dry lips. And as it moved, it was no less than Dhulfiqar. It ripped through the hearts of the enemy. They turned their faces and began to weep. Some of them called out and said, Yabna Sa'ad, if this baby is now not given water, another battle will end. Umar ibn Sa'd began to panic. He called Hurmala. He said, Hurmala, iqta qalam al-Husayn. Hurmala, this must end now. Hurmala came forward. Do you know which zalim is Hurmala? Hurmala is that man that after the battle of Karbala, when people would come to Imam Zainul Abidin and they would say to him, Yabna Rasulullah, Mukhtar has now caught Umar ibn Sa'd. Imam Zainul Abidin would say, Alhamdulillah, but is there any news of Hurmala? Then he would be told, Yabna Rasulullah, Khuli has been caught. He would say, Alhamdulillah, but has Hurmala been caught? This is the zalim Hurmala. Hurmala came forward. Hurmala looked at the baby. Then he took out an arrow from his quiver. It was a three-pronged arrow that is used to slaughter a camel. He made the baby's neck his target. Suddenly his hands began to quiver. Umar ibn Sa'd began saying, Oh Hurmala, I have never seen you shake like this. What is it that makes you hesitate? He said, come where I stand, Yabna Sa'd, and see what I see. The baby's mother is looking from the khayam. Ajrukum alallah. Bas Hurmala took an aim at the throat of the baby. As the arrow went flying into the air, now the arbab of Azah say, when the arrow came to the throat of the baby, فَانْقَلَبَ السَّبِي عَلَىٰ يَدِ عَبِي, the baby overturned in the hand of his father. فَدُبِيَ الطِّفْلِ مِنَ الْأُذُنِ إِلَى الْأُذُنِ وَمِنَ الْوَرِيدِ إِلَى الْوَرِيدِ, it ripped the baby's throat. It entered one ear and came out from the other. فَلَمَّا أَحَسَ الطِّفْلِ بِحَرَارَةِ السَّهْمِ, when the baby felt the heat of the arrow enter its body, أَخْرَجَ يَدَيْهِ مِنَ الْقِمَاطِ, it took its little arms out from its swaddled cloth. فَعَتَنَقَ أَبَاهُ الْحُسَيْنِ, then it puts its arms around the neck of Hussein. فَرَفْرَفَ يَدَيْ كَتَّيْرِ الْمَطْبُوحِ, then it began flapping its arms like a little bird that has been slaughtered. Ajrukum alallah, ajrukum alallah. I do not know how Hussein removed the arrow from the neck of Asghar. But now I understand when Imam Sahib al-Zaman says in Ziyarat Nahiya, قَدْ عَجِبَتْ مِنْ صَبْرِكَ مَلَائِكَةُ السَّمَاءِ, oh Hussein, the angels were astonished at your sabr when they saw what you did on Karbala. The angels were astonished to see the sabr of Hussein. This is what the Arbab of Azah say, what this is what they mean when they say, Hussein wo mazloom hai, jise rula rula ke mara gaya. Hai gharib Hussein, when he removed the arrow from the baby's throat, a fountain of blood erupted. Hussein took the blood in the palm of his hand. Inkar aasma ko hai, razi zameen nahi. Hussein, gharib Hussein, he wiped the blood on his face and said, Haqada alqa jaddi yawm al-qiyamah. This is how I will come before Rasulullah yawm al-qiyamah, with the blood of this baby on my face. Now Hussein put the baby back in his arm, covered him with his abba. He began walking back saying, Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un, ridham bi qada'ihi wa tasliman li amri. Suddenly Hussein saw Rabab. Then he stopped and began walking backwards. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. How should Hussein take the baby to its mother 7 times? Gharib Hussein went back and forth. He finally came forward. Zainab came out. Sakina came running out. Baba, have you quenched the thirst of my baby Ali? Yes, Sakina, Asghar's thirst has been quenched, but not with water. Hussein said to Zainab, Zainab hold Rabab. Zainab held Rabab. Hussein opened his abba. The Mu'arrikhin say, when Rabab saw her baby, she only said one thing and then she fainted. She looked at the baby's throat, then she said, Bunayya, Bunayya, amithluka yunhar. My child, our baby is like you, slaughtered like camels. Ajrukum Allah. When Rabab regained consciousness, Hussein took Rabab behind the tents. Hussein thought, if I bury this child, the mother will have some closure. Rabab held her baby. Hussein began making a small qabr with Dhulfiqar. Then Hussein laid his child. They shed tears on the qabr instead of water. When Asr Ashur came, Umar ibn Sa'd said, where is the baby that we slaughtered? Men were sent behind with spears. Rabab kept watching. Her heart stopped when a mal'oon pierced a spear in the ground. When it came out, the baby was on the spear. Rabab began crying. My child, for what sin are you being slaughtered a second time? Wa ghurbata, wa walada.